studios of Central Coast Public Radio KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Alex Strauss is my guest this week. She's contributed to Entertainment Weekly, The New York Times, Esquire, and many other publications. A few years ago, her book of short stories was published under the title The Joy of Funerals. So perhaps it's not a total surprise that her latest book deals with death, and it is called Death Becomes Them, Unearthing the Suicides of the Brilliant, the Famous, and the Notorious. Alex Strauss, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Okay. I know you can't judge a book by its cover, but for the benefit of our listeners or readers of the Kindle edition, the cover of your book, it's very colorful. It's yellow, it's turquoise and purple. It's got little tiny suicide icons of guns and nooses and skulls and oven doors. And on the back, there's this lovely picture of you, and you're very smiley and happy. So, I don't know, are you making light of death?
Absolutely not. You know, it is a very pop art cover, but I think that's part of our culture. You know, I'm a pop culture writer, I'm a trend journalist, but I think there's, of course, a very serious side to suicide. What we tried to do and what the goal was to celebrate the lives of 20 of the most important and influential icons in society. And it's also an overview of suicide, and we really document, you know, 250 celebrity or luminaries, but we take a specific and follow their final days of 20 of the most important. And I think the cover is colorful, and yes, I am smiling, but, you know, part of it, too, is that you want it to be a cover that people will gravitate towards. And I think if you just had something spilling out with blood, people might be a little concerned.
Oh, blood is big. What are you talking about?
Blood is big. Not so much for white pants, but on the whole, it's a traceable trail, certainly. But it certainly isn't to make light of anything. In fact, if anything, I think that, and I hope maybe you felt this way through the writing, but there was an enormous amount of research that went into understanding these people, you know, from Freud to Sylvia Plath and Hemingway and Virginia Woolf and Kurt Cobain and Diane Arbus, Vincent van Gogh, Mark Rothko, all of these amazing people, Dorothy Dandridge and Spalding Gray, to following their last days, but understanding the methodology, the pathology, what made them do it, how did they do it. I really just wanted to answer all the questions that seemed, you know, that the people needed answers to. And there was so much that we just unearthed. There was so much to, you know, it's the devil in the details that I hope will keep the readers, you know, interested in picking it up and continue to read each section.
Well, Alex, I can't help notice that you say we a lot. Who is the we? It just does your name, or is there a
it,
team?
It does. You know, it's and some of it is, I think, a habit, but some of it is after a year of research, you know, you really do feel that you're in a team effort. There are the publishers, and HarperCollins was so fantastic and really behind this kind of project. And I had some researchers, some interns doing throughout the year. We had divided this manuscript or this book into sections from artists and actors, authors, people in power, musicians, and so it is, at the end of the day, it really is a team effort between myself and my agent and the editor and the kids that did some research, and you really can't help but feel that. And then the we also, you can't help but feel it was with ghosts for an entire year. Very often after 9 or 10 hours of suicide material, you just want to call upon Hemingway's ghost and say, sit up at the bar with me and kick back a shot of tequila.
Well, there have been books that sort of, Hollywood Babylon springs to mind by Kenneth Anger. And he would often tell us, you know, what actors eventually committed suicide. Or here's a movie where, you know, look, three of these actors and these three all committed suicide. Were you writing this book thinking of catering to those of us who are obsessed with that kind of thing? Or is this an obsession of yours that you wanted to share with us, likewise obsessed?
That's a great question. I think it's twofold. One, I'm fascinated by human behavior. And I'm also fascinated in the stories. And there were things that, each of these people had a specific story, and even though they had all committed suicide, and that was sort of the theme, the way they did it, the reasons that they did it, how they did it, why they did it was so vastly different. I loved finding out the details about someone like Anne Sexton, the famous poet, who was in and out of mental institutions 22 times, had pills that she would call her kill-me pills, and that when she died, she wanted to be buried in a pine box, and she wanted a palindrome on her tombstone that said, I think I'm going to misquote this, but it's like, no rats live on stars or something. And, it, you know, backwards to forward would read the same thing, and she said that she took great, that it was a great comfort to her. So I found that interesting. I found it fascinating that when right before she killed herself, she took off all of her jewelry, put it in her handbag, put on her, stripped down naked, put on her mother's fur, had a number of glasses of vodka, and got into her car and turned on the ignition and died in the middle of the day. And so there was a story there wrapped up in these details that I found fascinating. And I was plagued by, you know, why would she take off her jewelry? What made her this time, you know, this was her ninth attempt. So how did this woman, who was really in and out of mental institutions, published, you know, was estranged from her husband, had two children, what kind of life was she living? And I found that through all these people that I researched. You know, Mark Roscoe was just as fascinating. He was found in his studio in a pool of blood in the full Jesus formation, having slit his upper arms, which is a little unusual, and he had OD'd supposedly on drugs, on pills. And then there was an enormous amount of information about perhaps, you know, there were counterfeiters and what they did with the art, and that the autopsy was incorrect and the blood work was incorrect and they had misspelt his name. And there was just all the stories, all the details came, no pun intended, came to life. And so there was a fascination with wanting to be a fair reporter, for wanting to help sort of tell the story and to try to trace where they were in their last week of their lives and then what happened. So it was just, it's my own personal, I guess, questions and intrigue, but I think I share this with other people who are fascinated by celebrities. And then part of it is also our culture. We are a celebrity fast food nation. We also want to be part of something greater than ourselves, which is why we feel the need to mourn together. And I guarantee that is my mother's generation knows where they were when Kennedy was shot. My generation will know where we all were when we found out that Kurt Cobain shot himself, that Spalding Gray went missing, and where we were when they found his body two months later. And many of us, it will be Michael Jackson, when Michael Jackson died and we came together as a nation.
Michael Jackson died? You're kidding. No, I'm sorry. We are.
You know what's fascinating? I didn't have a TV. I joke with people. I recently moved, and so I haven't had a TV for a while, and I feel very left out of some things. And my big joke is, you know, next you'll tell me that Michael Jackson's dead. People are like, are you serious? Yeah. And I think there is something about wanting to be part of something that's human nature, that we all yearn for. And there is we also live vicariously very often through some of these people. And they've also changed the way we live, how we see a picture, how we read a story, how we analyze something. Freud was one of the most notable assisted suicides at 83, and one of the few people don't know that Freud killed himself. And that he was a coke addict for a number of years, and that he smoked 20 cigars a day, and that he had jaw cancer and had 30 operations, and he, at the very end of his life, smelt so bad that his dog wouldn't even go near him. So these were the details that I found rather fascinating.
Lovely. What a lovely detail that was.
Yeah, you know, they don't bottle that as a perfume.
We're speaking, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Alex Strauss, and her book is called Death Becomes Them, Unearthing the Suicides of the Brilliant, the Famous, and the Notorious. And of course, you know, I guess one of the appeals of talking about the suicides of famous people, as opposed to all the ordinary people, I guess I should say, of people who have committed suicide, I guess it's the old Richard Corey, you know, the poem about the, you know, here's this rich guy who everybody wants to be, and yet he goes home and kills himself. So, you know, we love the celebrities and we think, wow, what a great life it would be to be rich and famous. And yet, it's not always the case.
I do also feel we do live a little vicariously through them because I think we're so drawn to, we feel, you know, they're very vocal, and because we are also this, you know, instant gratification society, we know things that ordinarily we wouldn't know about certain people. We are with them 24/7. There are people who have breakfast every day with Regis and Kelly, and there are people who have lunch every day with Oprah, and there are people, I mean, look at what's happening to Sandra Bullock. We know every detail of what's going on in her life, and so they are what is termed a familiar stranger. We feel we know them even though we technically don't. We feel connected to them because we know so much about them, and it's very one-sided, but you can't help but feel horribly for her. She's the all-American girl who is bright and funny and charming, and yet we are there watching, unfortunately, her marriage fall apart. And there is something that connects us to them. We can't, so we feel we know them. They are friends of ours. We can talk about these people as if they are part of our lives.
Okay, but also for you personally, you know, you have a book called The Joy of Funerals. In your book, you talk about how, you know, as a child, you looked at funerals as lovely family reunions. Do you have a, what about you? Do you have a dark side? Where have you ever had a suicidal tendency yourself?
I have, luckily, I have not had a suicidal tendency. That doesn't mean I am a little dark, but I think that we very often confuse darkness for honesty. You know, people are, we have a friend's husband recently died, and, the woman, one of my mother's friends said, you know, I only want to remember good things about him. It's only good things, and that's all it'll be. And I guess that's a nice way to look at it, but it's also very unrealistic. It's part of, you know, life is very hard, and it's a struggle for most people to get through the day. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that is life, and I think that's okay to admit. The people in the book, they were all struggling, whether it was severe depression, severe mood swings, bipolar, addiction, maybe both. You know, life for them, it's because they're brilliant that they have such cravings and issues and depression. Is it because they have such highs and lows? There's a lot we don't know about, but I think it's a mistake to say someone is dark or they are, they talk about dark subjects when in actuality it's an honesty. I think I'm very much for honesty, and I do look at things a little bit different. So I can't fault people for saying, you know, that's a really weird topic to talk about. But the funeral thing came up for me because we were not especially close with a lot of people in my family. I'm an only child. I'm the only child ever, as far back as you can trace. Everyone but my parents had more than one child, and my parents could have had many and just for whatever reason decided not to. And my mother has a brother that she's not very close with. My father had my father recently passed away, and he wasn't terribly close with his sister. And I think that's really awful and sad because family is one of the few things you're born with. And so growing up, I really didn't know my cousins, and I didn't know my aunts and uncles, and a funeral was the only time I got to meet everybody, and there is something really wonderful about being defined and learning where you come from and learning what you're a part of. And so as a child, I learned to look forward to funerals because they were reunions for me. You know, in my 5-year-old, 10-year-old brain, these were reunions. And we were very fortunate. They weren't, it wasn't like someone was, you know, 20 and died of leukemia. It was Great Aunt Edna, who was, you know, 89 and died of natural causes. So we were fortunate in that respect, and I learned to look forward to a funeral because it was a reunion of sorts for me. And that's how it all started. And then the novel was really taking the concept, what if you had a character who went to other people's funerals because she was so lonely and her need for connection was so great? And what you find when you read The Joy of Funerals is all the stories are intertwined. So you, in the first 8 short stories, someone has died, but in the novella, the main character goes to all the funerals of the people you've just read about, and now you get to meet the characters for a second time.
You must be so much fun. We're talking with Alex Strauss, and her book is called Death Becomes Them. Of course, I'm sure you are a lot of fun, and you probably don't think about death and talk about death all the time. But
no, I was going to strip down naked now and run around the house while I was on the phone with you. So I am, and that's without the tequila. I am a lot of fun. I hope, you know, I'm fun, but I'm realistic. I think that, you know, it's very interesting when I go on. You know, sometimes I go on dates, or I'm on JDate or whatever, or Match.com, and the minute I see a profile that from a guy who says, I'm really into having a good time and just having fun. I gloss right over it because I don't think that it is. It's not realistic. There's something missing that he doesn't want a real. That's not a real relationship. It's lovely to have fun, but you just can't have fun all the time. It's smoke and mirrors.
Well, but you were mentioning, you know, people. What kinds of reactions have you gotten from people? What do they say to you when you say, oh, yes, well, I just wrote this wonderful book, Unearthing the Suicides of the Brilliant and the Famous and the Notorious. What do
if I'm on a date, usually the guy will raise his hand and say, I need another drink. it varies. There are people who are as fascinated, I think, by these icons and by these amazing celebrities and luminaries. You know, it's I'm not chicklet. It's interesting. I have a new novel coming out in June called Based Upon Availability, and it all takes place at the Four Seasons Hotel and how, again, these characters are interwoven into each other's lives. And that's probably the most commercial thing I've written. I'm interested in what happens behind closed doors. I want the gritty details. I think part of it is human nature. We are interested in... It's abnormal for someone to hear a suicide happen for that person not to say, how did they die? It's, I think, what creates our morbid curiosity and what makes us, I guess, unfortunately, slow that car down when we're passing an accident on the road. But I think there's also a human aspect to it, that we are looking to connect to something, and we are trying to understand somebody else's pain. And hopefully we're also there to celebrate a life. You know, it's not a morbid book. It is about remembering and thinking about the contributions, and also taking a moment to say, it is sad that these people aren't here. Can you imagine what they would have contributed had they not killed themselves? You know, we're never going to see another painting by Van Gogh. We're never going to read another short story by Hemingway, and we're never going to get to see, unfortunately, another monologue performed by Spalding Gray. So in one sense, we've also been cheated out of something.
Right, and then I guess there's the other kinds of suicide, like, you know, Hitler's, which is like, you know, well, gosh, if he was going to commit suicide, couldn't he have done it, you know, 20 years earlier and saved us a lot of trouble?
He was the one person I really grappled with. You know, as a Jew, you're part of our religion is to tell the story, and I felt part of my it was part of my duty to tell the story of a madman, of a horrific, horrible, psychotic madman who really destroyed so much. And for all those non-believers who always insist the Holocaust never happened, I felt very responsible to tell a story. And we did decide as a group between the publishers and everyone that he, as unfortunate as it is and how despicable and horrific it was, he did contribute to society in the most negative way. He's the only one that is not to be celebrated, obviously. He's really the only one that you really just need to say, if only I had known and I could have done something, if I could have gone back in time. He really was the one guy that you just wanted to say, if I would have done everything to stop a madman, I would have been him.
And some of the stories you tell, I mean, I kind of appreciated when you were talking about Virginia Woolf and you talked about her drowning and you actually described, you know, what that would be like. And so it makes you definitely wonder, you know, what you know, of all the different ways that you could commit suicide, why would anybody want to do it this way? You talked about her maybe obsession with that particular form of death.
Yeah, drowning, I found out, was really the, next to self-stabbing, drowning's probably the worst, because your body, it's the only method that your body will automatically kick into a self-survival mode. And the body literally fights the water, and it's very painful and just horrific. And what I did for each luminary was we paired it up with highlights from their life, obviously, but also facts and factoids, as we call them, of what it is like to drown or what happens to the body. It was fascinating to find out that people who stab themselves or when they're slitting their wrists will always leave hesitation marks normally. And that is actually one of the main things that forensics or autopsies or police people all will look for, to see the difference between someone who's been murdered and someone who's killed themselves. Usually there's about 8 to 10 hesitation marks on the body. And people who stab themselves will most likely pull their clothing away from them so that they can actually see the area, which is why it was so confusing when Elliot Smith's body was uncovered. And there was not one hesitation mark, and he didn't pull his clothing away from his body. But he had tried to kill himself that way a number of, certainly one time before, where he had stabbed himself. And there was also a Post-it that was found, and his name was actually misspelled as well in the medical examiner's report, I believe, or in the police report. So there was a lot of controversy and a lot of conspiracy theories. Between the musicians, they were the murkiest. We did find some themes, which was quite amazing. All the people in power, people like Hitler, Cleopatra, Socrates, Abby Hoffman, Freud, and a man named Alan Turing, who's credited as creating the first computer, killed themselves with poison. And all of our actors were cremated, and all of the artists, the visual artists, were self-mutilators to some extent. And all of our writers had severe father figure issues. And they tended to write in the first person, which there was a study done that said if poets, specifically the poets, were more apt to write in first person, they were more apt to be depressed. So some of this stuff was really amazing to learn. It was a wonderful education, too. I mean, I never learned any of this in high school or college.
Well, maybe your book will become a text. But how did you come to collect these stories and write this book?
I wrote a proposal. I realized that no one had ever done a book like this, and I was really surprised that had not happened. There was certainly the Babylon book, as you mentioned earlier, and there was a book, I believe, on rock icons' last days, but they didn't all specifically apply to suicide. I mean, you certainly had the fellow from the Doors, and you had Janis Joplin, and you had Jimi Hendrix. So you had people like that grouped into some of the others who had Elvis and people like that who probably, you know, Elvis was an accidental overdose, but then we did have some of the major players who committed suicide. It was all grouped into one book. And I was amazed to find that no one had ever done this before. And it seemed like such a no-brainer that somebody, I just couldn't believe, it was very strange, and I just the lights all went off, and I said, wow, that's really fabulous, I should do that. And I guess it seemed like a logical step from working on the funeral collection to doing this, and sort of being this, what I've fallen into, this pop, you know, culture trend specialist who deals with death a lot, or dark subjects. So it felt very right, and the timing felt right about it as well. And now, unfortunately, you know, you've got people like Alexander McQueen, who recently killed himself, and the Infinite Jest fellow, Wallace.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who killed himself in 2008, and Sylvia Plath's son, Nicholas, recently killed himself, and then there was Dash Snow, the artist. So it seems to continually be a timeless subject, unfortunately.
It is, you know, it's very fascinating. Certainly it's really interesting. You know, Bing Crosby had two children, both of whom committed suicide with a shotgun a year apart. See, you missed that one.
Well, you know, I guess part of it was Bing Crosby didn't kill himself, and then so to really...
To extend it this way.
Right.
There was also one that fascinated me when I was young, which the there was a comedy team called Clark and McCullough, and Paul McCullough was getting a shave, and he took the razor away from the barber and slit his throat.
That's for our sequel. You know, we couldn't put everything in one book.
Death Becomes Them too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, well, if no, readership is good, we'll write a second one.
You think you will? Seriously?
There are people that I think, now, of course, what's happening, there
people
are more
are
stories
to like
tell.
Me.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate that there's a plethora of stories to tell. There's something very sad and unfortunate about that. It's a subject that, but it's a subject that not only is in the limelight, but that we're ready to talk about. We talk about, we're all very comfortable talking about depression right now. We're all very comfortable with these addiction shows that are on television. We're very open to discussing this and to bringing it to the forefront. And more people are coming out to say that it's a struggle to get through the day, that they think about suicide often, and that should be taken very seriously.
Absolutely. And it's a serious book, and it's very well written. And
Thank you.
I had a bloody good time reading your
book. Oh, bloody good time.
And,
had to throw that in.
I'm sure our listeners will enjoy it, too. And the author is Alex Strauss. The book is called Death Becomes Them, and her upcoming novel is called Based Upon Availability. That will be out this summer.
Yeah, it's my return to fiction. It's been about 7 years since The Joy of Funerals came out, and I'm so excited to return to something that I have such a passion for. And there's something really wonderful about being able to create these characters' lives and sit with them and have tea with them and see what they're going to do. I'm always surprised by what they end up wanting to say. Fiction writing is very different from nonfiction. With nonfiction, there was a real format. You know, I understood these people. I was fascinated by their lives. There was a story that we needed to tell. I only had a certain amount of words to do it. We wanted to pair it with a fact. I was on a very tight schedule and a tight regimen. With fiction, you know, all bets are off. You create, and then at some point, and this sounds so new agey, but the characters really do speak on their own, and they, at some point, will tell the story themselves. And it's a wonderful process.
Well, I hope you'll come back and talk to us about it when your novel comes out.
I would love that. I would really be honored to do that, because this has been a lovely experience.
That knocks off another episode of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. Thanks very much to Alex Strauss, author of Death Becomes Them, for being my guest this week. And thanks, as always, to our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Be sure to check us out on Facebook and iTunes and our podcast page, KUSP.org. I'll see you again next week. This is Gary Shapiro for From the Bookshelf. Good night.